Welcome back to CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio on Gender and School.
Next, we will hear from Steve Solomon, who is a social worker with the Triangle Program in Toronto.
The Triangle Program is a high school dedicated to the needs of queer youth.
The Triangle Program is a high school classroom. It's part of one of our alternative schools, Oasis Alternative, and it was designed 9 years ago to meet the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender students who'd either left school or were thinking of leaving school, dropping out, because of homophobic harassment. So for students who were feeling unsafe and not fitting in with their school environment, the Triangle Program is a program to help students come back to school, get reattached in a positive way, and to actually study some curriculum that is queer positive and reflects a little bit of their reality.
How exactly did this program come about? Did it come out through a strong demand?
Triangle can sort of be understood as sort of an innovation within the Toronto School Board. Going all the way back to the 1980s, the former Toronto Board of Education, we've since been amalgamated, had begun to address issues around homophobia, had developed an explicit anti-homophobia policy, and had established a counseling program for lesbian and gay students across our school board. So that opened up probably in the late 80s, early 90s, with counseling to students, teachers, parents, and families, and then also began to do anti-homophobia workshops in the classrooms. while meeting with the students in a counseling capacity, it became apparent that counseling just sort of wasn't enough. We could support students for sure. However, the climates of their schools were such that they were feeling unsafe and being targeted with homophobic harassment. So realizing that there was sort of a pool of students who were dropping out of school, the next step was to create a safe space for them to come back to school, get attached in a positive way, and earn the credits as they work towards their high school diploma. So you can understand the Triangle Program as a next step when it came to providing an inclusive environment for our students. Just to be sure, too, it's a transitional program, so students don't get their entire diploma at Triangle, but they can stay for about a year to a year and a half, sort of get grounded again in school, get the support they need, and then move into the broader school system to finish up their credits as they work towards their diploma.
You mentioned that the Triangle Program provides students with an opportunity to study a curriculum that's a lot more queer positive. Mm-hmm. How does this curriculum fit into the wider curriculum of the Toronto District School Board? And is the Toronto District School Board fairly supportive of the Triangle Program?
Yes, actually, the creation of the program was supported in a variety of different sectors, both from sort of the broader queer community in Toronto, supportive school trustees at the time who were the ones overseeing the school board, supportive principals and other administrators. So there were a number of parties that were had a stake in sort of the creation of Triangle, and including the teaching staff at Oasis, where Triangle found its home. The curriculum, as much as the Ontario Ministry of Education provides sort of guidelines for school boards in terms of outcomes expected in different subject areas, individual school boards then devise their curriculum according to their local needs. So within the TDSB at Triangle, say here's an example, an English credit at Triangle would comprise itself of a coming out story. So students would do a coming out unit where they would write their coming out story, read novels with a coming out theme, do research on supports and resources for queer kids coming out. So at the end of it, they've learned how to sort of learn the mechanics of writing, so an essay. They've been able to do some research and to do some reading. So at the end of it, the students, whether they're, say, in grade 9 or grade 12, would earn either a quarter credit or a half a credit towards an English. So if they're working at the grade 9 level, that would go towards a grade 9 English. If it was a grade 12 student, then they would work towards a grade 12 English credit. So the content of the subject area is what sort of makes Triangle unique. So studying English at Triangle is a little bit different than sort of the material perhaps used at one of our mainstream high schools. So it fits within those guidelines of the school board, which then are sort of guided by the Ministry of Education's very broad descriptions of expectations.
Throughout this documentary, we're also trying to put a large focus on the problems that transgender students face, which are arguably quite unique from the problems of queer students who are able to fit into a gender binary in school. I was wondering if you'd be able to speak a bit to the problems that transgender students are facing right now in Toronto schools.
I think you're absolutely right around sort of the unique experience for trans students, wherever they might be in their sort of gender identification or their process of perhaps transitioning. What they would have in common with queer students in general, though, is often the recipients of homophobia. Quite often, the words lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans are often lumped together, which sort of, you know, negates some of the unique aspects to each of those identities. But for trans students in particular, it's kind of that next margin that leaves a lot of students not sure where to turn. I meet with a number of students who identify as trans out in the broader system, and for many of them, there's just no way that they would even begin at this point to think of coming out as trans in their high school environment. They might not even talk to their own families about this, or they've got few social supports. So for lots of these students, they're often trying to find a really unique space within which to understand themselves, and then also try and put together, you know, what's expected of them, which is a high school education. So there's a particular aspect to trans student identity that makes it quite difficult. Excuse me. But within our school board policy, you know, there is at least some official recognition of gender identity as an aspect that falls within our own school board's human rights policy. But I think the reality on the ground is that trans students face some additional hurdles, or very different hurdles, I guess is a better way to put it, when it comes to their ability to express themselves and to feel comfortable and safe in doing so.
Maybe you could elaborate on some of those hurdles that they're facing within school.
I think for students who identify as trans and for whom they're looking at, say, adopting a gender identity that differs from their physical or their birth sex, so to present in ways that make sense for them in terms of the world, often the reaction from other students and also from other staff, you know, they're quite confounded by it. So quite often, I think a lot of the work is around not so much the trans students, but all the reactions to it. So the transphobia, that, you know, people's misunderstandings of what trans means in relation to, you know, sexual orientation, like the two are quite distinct phenomena. But even some basic, when I've worked with students who've actually, over the period of time, have transitioned from male to female or female to male, one aspect of trans identity, just some of the daily stuff around which bathroom can they use? You know, where can they feel safe in doing so? And I've worked with a number of students who just don't use the bathroom at school. They wait till they go home. And it's grossly unfair, given sort of the rest of us don't even think twice about which bathroom we can use. I worked with one student for whom the solution was that the student was given access to a staff washroom. So just really things that, when I raised this with classrooms and with, you know, staff and teachers, that people don't even think twice about sort of, you know, the privilege that comes with, you know, identifying with your biological sex. Those day-to-day things can often be a huge hurdle because it definitely interferes with your ability to sort of move through the day. But then also just the general understanding of what it means to be trans and people's really gross misunderstandings that it often gets conflated or confused with sexual orientation. So that's where the common homophobia comes in. So kids that get called fag or dyke or queer, often the perpetrators of homophobia don't really make a distinction. But the bathroom aspect has always been a challenge for a number of students. And individual schools have tried to come up with some creative solutions that both meet the needs of the students and also that's something that's workable within their own school.
One thing that we're trying to look at also is whether or not students in Canada are still being taught in school with a very rigid gender binary. I was wondering if you have seen in most mainstream schools in Toronto that students are being taught in a very gender rigid binary, and whether or not you think this is problematic.
Oh, it's absolutely out there. And we do, the other piece of work is doing anti-homophobia workshops with kids from grade 1 to grade 12. So we're often drawing parallels to sexism as a homophobia as a weapon of sexism. and we can very quickly get to a discussion around sort of gender role stereotypes and what happens when people step out of their expected gender role. So I would definitely agree that that very powerful binary of not just, you know, either male or female, but to be male means all these things. It's a very strict criteria. Or to be a woman, it means all these things in a very strict criteria. And that for people who live through the world and experience the world in a different reality that maybe doesn't conform to either or might include some of both, then you can very, very much see some, I often, you know, have some very resistant discussions in classrooms with students who really struggle to sort of step away from it's an either or discussion to something that could be both and something that could be neither. But it's really difficult to sort of get them even to recognize the gender, the power of the gender stereotype. I often sort of equate it to, it's like trying to explain water to fish, right? That's all they've seen, right? So part of it is to kind of get in there a little bit and interrupt their notions of what it means to be male, what it means to be female. And we do that through activities around name-calling and the ways in which femininity is very much degraded in our society and the ways in which masculinity can really pigeonhole boys and young men around their ability to express emotion. So I still, before we even get to, I think, in some meaningful discussions around, you know, trans issues and transphobia, we have to shake loose a little bit of that gender, that binarism that you spoke of, that it's still very, very much prominent in the lives of lots of the students, both in mainstream and alternative schools.
And what are some of the ways that we can begin to shake ourselves loose from those binaries?
It's been interesting. I think some of my most revealing moments are working with kids in grade 1 and grade 2. We do anti-homophobia work around family diversity, but very quickly talk to them about what can constitute a family, for example, right? And you want to talk about powerful, dominant ideologies, right? The first example is always mom and dad and 2.3 kids. But, of course, the reality of a lot of our students is that their families can look a lot different than that. But when you actually have a discussion with little kids about the toys they play with, it's fascinating, right? We'll ask them, you know, who plays with this toy, right? Say it's a, you know, something that's been constructed as a male toy, whether it's a truck, as opposed to, say, a doll or a particular kind of doll. Even very early on, you realize how powerful the image has been to, for kids to sort of internalize or take in that this is how boys have to be and this is how girls have to be. And I think by introducing some more ambiguity and also giving kids the permission to play with any toy they want to, because so many kids want to play with so many different toys, but very quickly they're given these sort of social reminders that, you know, if a boy plays with a doll, or at least a certain kind of doll, he's going to, you know, that invites all kinds of teasing and taunting and homophobia. Or if a young girl expresses interest in things that are constructed as mostly male, then she gets a few raised eyebrows and some remarks that way. But I think it begins very early on, just in the socialization process of boys and girls. We have to introduce some more choice. You know, it sounds kind of not cliche, but it sounds kind of basic, but just the ways in which we approach the notion of play when it comes to kids, right? We're still very much, I think, in the beginning stages of trying to shake that loose a little bit.
And finally, we also want to leave our listeners with a sense of empowerment. And I think the Triangle program is a very empowering thing for queer youth. What do you seek to leave kids with who are coming through the Triangle program, and what skills and knowledge are you trying to give them?
You know, we've had about almost 300 students come through our doors in the last 9 years. And, you know, for so many of them, it's interesting, and in so many, it's almost a classic example where, you know, kids have stopped going to school, and then they find out about Triangle, and they suddenly have, like, 100% attendance. Like, they, students who come early to school, who do, like, it's almost suddenly, like, flicking the switch back on for school in a very positive light. So to give students back, I think, what is their right to a high school education, but also one that they can feel sort of part of. I think students who can find out a bit more about queer history and how that shaped through the years, to give them the ability to ask really critical questions around homophobia, heterosexism, transphobia. I think when students are given those sorts of tools that they're going to need when they move on from Triangle to other spaces and places, it suits them or it bodes well for them to be able to navigate. Like the homophobia doesn't end when they leave Triangle. They often have to jump back into the pool again, but hopefully with enough supports, resources, and connections, both from within themselves and then, of course, without on the outside as well, that students feel that they are good enough, that they are capable, that they are almost worthy, that much of what homophobia has taken away from them, our attempt is to sort of put back some of those pieces. So from one level of self-esteem to suddenly doing really well in math. When you don't have to worry about people calling you names and just surviving the school day, I think in that regard, people can, I think students can be kind of re-energized in some ways. Now, Triangle's not perfect. You know, for some students it works really well, for other students it doesn't, and we recognize our limitations in that regard. But for a lot of our students who very early on began to count themselves out of even finishing high school, let alone post-secondary, it's interesting to raise that with students who think, well, I never thought I would go on to finish high school, let alone go to college or university. I think that speaks volumes to sort of the impact of homophobia up until we had a chance to meet them. So I think a lot of it is actually both giving back a positive school experience, but also helping them sort of rediscover their strengths, which I think have always been there, but have been worn down and eroded by an incredibly homophobic school system.
I'm on the phone with Marlo Ritchie, who works for Project Max and Project 10. Maybe you could start off by explaining what exactly... Well, we'll start with Project 10.
Okay.
What is it?
Sure. Project 10 is a community organization that's been around for about 12 years in Montreal. And we offer support services, information, referrals, workshops to many different youth and health and social service providers and community workers, but in particular youth who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, transgender, or youth who are questioning their sexual orientation and or their gender identity. Some of our frontline services include a phone line in the afternoons, drop-in groups, discussion groups, individual support sessions that are free, confidential, and bilingual. And we run on a very tight budget, but we're a big team with big hearts. So I'm pretty proud of the work that we do in the community.
Maybe you could also explain Project Max for us and go through what the differences, the essential differences between Project Max and Project 10.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about the history of Project Max. About 3 years ago, there was a team of workers here who were going about their daily business, running the drop-ins and staffing the phone line. And one youth in particular came across Project 10 services at the time. And this youth was questioning their gender identity and was, for example, using pronouns and a name other than what had been assigned to them at birth or by their peer and family networks. And the team here validated that, and they were totally, like, supportive and everything. But at the same time, they were lacking in training on these issues. And and this is really normal in terms of the youth who access our services. Sometimes, you know, a month will go by or 2 months or longer, and we won't hear from them. You know, sometimes they'll just drop in to one drop-in or have one phone call, and then, you know, they're on their way. Well, unfortunately, the team heard through the grapevine that this youth didn't make it. This youth, who is known as Max, died of an overdose. And that prompted a reflective process with the team here. And they asked themselves, are we doing enough for these youth? And what can we do to be more proactive and to increase the visibility of services to gender-questioning youth, transsexual and transgender youth? So they put together a program proposal and submitted it to the AIDS Community Action Program in Health Canada. And Project Max was born. But it's incredible. I mean, I was just going through some of our files here today, and we have binders and binders full of calls and emails from youth in the Montreal area and youth off-island, 3 weeks ago, I had a worker, a social worker, drive here 2 hours with a youth to access our services. I have social workers calling me from the Montreal Children's Hospital saying, I have a youth here who's questioning their gender. What do I do? You know, like, there's just, the need is so high, and yet the funding going into services is so low that it's overwhelming sometimes as a worker, you know. Another reality that we're working with is that these youth are really at risk. They deal with discrimination and violence on a daily basis in schools, from family, from the health and social service system, in the streets, from the government. And this has a major impact on their overall health and well-being. We see these youth engaging in high-risk behaviors as a result of this discrimination that they face on a daily basis. You know, some people who are not familiar with the needs of the trans community, once they start learning more about the needs, they're like, wow, this is kind of like the gay and lesbian movement 30 years ago. And it does feel like that sometimes, because the needs are so high. There's so much overt bashing that's happening, that these youth are surviving. And yet, where do they go?
Maybe you could just kind of elaborate on some of the specific problems that youth are coming to you with.
Let's talk about elementary school, for example. Recently, I got a call from a worker who says, okay, I'm, you know, the school counselor referred this youth to me because I'm the quote-unquote specialist, right? And I don't know how to help this youth. This youth is 12 years old. They are being referred to by two different names by their peers. And they want to access the bathroom that other people think they shouldn't access. So there's a really concrete example of, you know, like a trans youth just struggling to be themselves, to just carry about, you know, their business and, like, you know, just be in school. And yet the system around them, the system is freaking out. Like, the system doesn't know what to do with this youth. And they call us and they're like, what do we do? So, And I mean, this youth, I've been trying to reach this youth, even. And I've given information to the worker to give to the youth, and I'm still waiting for that phone call, you know? So it's, that's one example. Elementary school is so gendered as a place, you know? Like, girls line up here, boys line up here, all that good stuff, right? There's a lot of schools where you have to wear uniforms, and that can be totally, like, just, that can be horrible for trans youth who have to wear a uniform that doesn't correspond with their identity and who they are. Not to mention trans youth, because they don't necessarily fit, like, the ascribed gender roles, and other youth in general, you know, youth who just don't fit those quote-unquote masculine and feminine norms, are bashed. You know, like, they are singled out, and they're faced with verbal and physical harassment in the school, like in the halls and in the bathrooms and in the playgrounds. You know, there's been major studies on homophobia, for example, that have proven that there's a common denominator, and that's gender, and that there's something going on here in terms of gender roles that impacts on, you know, the common epithets that we'll hear, like faggot, sissy, dyke, you know, queer, whatever, that are thrown around on a daily basis in schools. And once again, youth who quote-unquote don't fit in are targeted.
How have you gone about, empowering mm-hmm. the youth you're working with to work with these problems in school?
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it involves doing accompaniment to, like, if they've already started working with a guidance counselor, for example, or someone outside the system. Often, especially if they're younger, it's that person that contacts us because of our budget. Like, our name isn't even out there as much as it could and should be, right? So sometimes we have sometimes we're limited in terms of how much we can actually work directly with youth, especially when they're, say, under 14. Above 14, youth are using the internet and they're finding us, you know? Like, we get a lot of emails through the internet. We use basic intervention techniques, you know, I hate to use that expression, but, you know, active listening and validation and trying to figure out, like, doing a needs assessment to figure out, well, what are you most at risk for? What are you most worried about right now? And how can we support you in building, you know, a safer, you know, life for yourself. Sometimes they need just basic information on terminology. You know, sometimes they've never heard the word transsexual or transgender, or they don't know that there's other youth out there who are like them. And just knowing that this isn't normal, that, you know, this is part of the beauty of human life, and that, yes, there are other people who are questioning their gender or who have these experiences, is very reassuring to them. There's so much isolation and shame, you know, that can surround being trans or questioning your gender. And then also in terms of workers, and empowering workers to be more proactive and be more allied. The previous coordinators did a fantastic job of researching and preparing a guide. It's called a guide to sexual reassignment surgery or gender reassignment surgery in Quebec, and it's for youth, health and social service providers and advocates or allies. And this is like a, you know, 80-page guide with frequently asked questions by youth and community workers or health providers and educators. And it's great. It's like one-stop shopping. It's a fabulous document, and it's available now for people who are interested. It's available in French and English, and it's free, though we welcome donations, of course. So they can contact us at 989-4585 to get a copy of the guide. Also, just to kind of go back to the roots of Project Max here and to bring up an event that was coordinated by the Transgender Alliance at McGill, there was a Trans Day of Remembrance last fall, and I think this will be an annual event. And this was a really moving event for me, and it was a time to reflect on the people who we have lost and to reflect on what it means to survive on a daily basis. And to look at, you know, the systemic nature of the oppression that trans people face. And that there's a big website around the Trans Day of Remembrance that people can find on the net. It was happening simultaneously in cities like, at least around North America and perhaps in other countries as well.
Maybe you could share some of the most positive feedback you've gotten since you've started with this, or I mean, just some signs that you have been making, you know, empowering moves in people's lives.
Okay. Well, recently we were doing a grant application, and I put a call out for testimonials from youth who have used our services or who have at least known that we've existed. And some of the stories that we got back were amazing, and were very, very intimate and very significant for me to read. I also found them very motivating because there was a lot of sharing of suffering in those stories. And I mean, to me, that's fuel, right? Like, that is concrete proof that something is terribly wrong, that there's so many people who are suffering, and yet, you know, we have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, blah, blah, blah. Well, that is not extending to everybody. And that's something that needs to be tackled, you know, on major governmental levels as well. Positive story. Okay, sorry. Positive story is a youth recently, 19 years old youth, came up to me and said, in the context of this asking for testimonials, that he believes that if Project Max wasn't there, that he wouldn't have made it. And that, to me, was very, very moving, because that spoke to why we started in the first place.
You've been listening to CKUT's Long-Term Memory radio series on gender and school. This piece has been produced by the CKUT Community News Collective, working towards a world without gender borders.